From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, her ex-husband has allegedly made death threats against her while he's been in prison. Now he's about to be paroled, and a Michigan mother fears she's out of options.
There was an incident that occurred about 2 weeks ago where I had to call 911, and it took them an hour and 6 minutes to respond to my call and get to my house. And I knew at that moment that I can't stay here. It's not safe for us.
Survivors of domestic violence should not have to displace themselves and their children because of assailant behavior. And that is exactly what is happening here.
And Sarah Seeley, the woman who disguised herself as a man to serve with Michigan troops during the Civil War.
She was injured and served honorably. She was tenacious. And she deserved a pension as much as anybody else. Her only roadblock was her gender.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Environmental programs all across Michigan are in danger from budget cuts. Not just the spending cuts in President Trump's budget proposal, but state cuts as well. It's a 1-2 punch that has environmental groups in Michigan very worried. The Michigan Environmental Council and the Michigan League of Conservation Voters commissioned public sector consultants to do a study, examine what we would lose if these programs are cut or eliminated. James Clift is a policy analyst with the Michigan Environmental Council. James, let's start at the federal level. We have heard very clearly the president's budget would completely eliminate money for the Great Lakes Restoration Project. And at the same time, there's a $2.6 billion cut to the budget of the EPA. What would we lose in Michigan from that?
Yeah, so if you look at the EPA budget overall, about half of the money they get goes back to the states in the form of grants. So if you eliminate 25% of their funding, that's going to be felt at the state level. And that really is the core of our Michigan programs. We get approximately $150 million a year in these EPA grants. And these are the clean water program, the clean air program. These are people on the street that go to make sure that companies are in compliance with their permits to discharge air pollution or water pollution into our environment. These are the ones who are looking at brownfield contaminated sites and trying to make sure the communities around them are protected. Efforts to address, you know, hazardous algae blooms in Lake Erie. All of these programs get some of that federal money. So if that gets chopped, that's going to be layoffs, and that means that there's not going to be that level of oversight and not going to be that level of comfort that we're doing what we need to do to protect our communities.
And then at the state level, we're seeing lawmakers in Lansing trimming the DEQ budget?
Yeah, so they've cut an extra $10 million out of the state budget. And what's really, really disturbing in my mind, they're assuming $30 million extra dollars from the federal level as part of their budget. Not a cut, but they're actually assuming an increase in federal funding. We're really worried that that's not going to happen. We're going to see a cut instead. And then on top of that, a cut of another $10 million. These programs are really going to suffer.
And particularly, what are some of the state efforts that you fear?
Yeah, so one of the big issues has been this contaminated property cleanup program, where we have been relying on Clean Michigan Initiative money. That was bond money passed by the voters in 1998. Those monies have now been exhausted. So that program is seeing a significant kind of reduction in effort to make sure that those sites are clean. And we've seen a number of problems across the state with these old legacy sites. In the city of Ann Arbor, the Gelman Science site, where they're tracking this plume and people have to keep pulling people off their drinking water wells. Up in Oscoda, Michigan, Air Force Base up there has a contaminated plume. These are old contaminated sites where we really haven't been paying enough attention to them and the impact that they might be having in our community. So that program is subject to cut. The oil and gas oversight program, so these are the people that oversee oil and gas drilling in Michigan. That program is seeing a significant shortfall.
And then as you talk about that, I think of the Superfund program, but that's going to have a 30% cut, or at least it's proposed.
It is. And, you know, there are a lot of these are the legacy programs of what are we doing with the contamination that is left over from our industrial age. But still, if we don't get it now, it is our communities to get exposed. And unfortunately, we've had the Department of Health and Human Services come in and evacuate buildings because contaminated groundwater comes in contact with the foundation. these toxic fumes seep into the basement, and they've had to evacuate buildings because of those toxic fumes. So paying attention to those old sites, figuring out where they are, getting them cleaned up, so that communities can know that their air is safe, that their water is safe, I think is a big part of the programs that are going to be hurt by these budget cuts.
We're hearing this theme from so many groups. I've been talking with them, and here you are with this new study spelling out how it could hurt Michigan. Do you truly believe that Congress and state lawmakers are willing to rethink the proposed cuts? And politically speaking, is that even possible, given that the president's party controls Congress and the state legislature?
We hope that they rethink them. We hope they revisit them. They usually do some adjusting as they kind of go through the year. Either they end up with less money, you know, or sometimes they end up with more money. But the fact that they're putting money into the rainy day fund, which is good, but the bottom line is that, okay, at what expense? You know, at what risk are we trying to sock that money away? And are these programs really doing the job that we're asking them to do? And let's be creative. You know, should we be thinking about another bond program to get more money available here? Or should we be thinking about different ways to fund these programs? I like to show people the Minnesota model, where they dedicated a portion of their sales tax to environmental programs and protecting communities across the state. That was a 25-year commitment that voters in the state of Minnesota made to make sure their communities are safe. I think Michigan needs to explore long-term funding mechanisms like that to have that same level of comfort to make sure that the air and water is safe to be around and swim in, to breathe, all of those things.
Well, those of you who want to reach out, listening to us talk, and want to reach out to our state legislators and to our members of Congress, you can get all the information you need by reading the report. Just go to the Michigan Environmental Council website, environmentalcouncil.org. James Cliff, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Detroit's reputation as a high-crime city has not gone away, although its crime rate is down substantially. It's been falling since the 1980s. But there are areas of the city that are not as safe as others. Michigan Radio's Lester Graham with the Detroit Journalism Cooperative looks at crime in the neighborhoods.
I recently went to Detroit Police Department's 5th Precinct to ride along on a patrol.
I am MPO DeAndre Gaines. That stands for Neighborhood Police Officer, which is Community Relations. We are headed to Morningside neighborhood.
That's on Detroit's east side. This year, I'm spending a lot of my time in Morningside. Some of the business owners and residents there have complained about the crime rate in their neighborhood. Gaines shakes his head.
Morningside is still a good area. You know, everywhere in the city, you're going to have your pockets of crime. You know, that's everywhere. But I wouldn't say Morningside is no different than any of the other areas in the city of Detroit.
The crime rate statistics for the neighborhood by itself were not made available. However, Morningside is within the 5th Precinct. The Detroit Police Department did provide crime stats for all the precincts, and the number of crimes in the 5th Precinct were comparatively average. 5 of the 12 precincts had lower numbers of crime. However, those raw numbers are deceiving. The population is different in each precinct. When you calculate the number of crimes per 10,000 residents, the 5th Precinct has the second highest crime rate in the city. Only the 3rd Precinct, which stretches from New Center to Mexicantown, had a higher crime rate. Here's the thing, though. Crime is down across the city. Last year, for the entire city of Detroit, the murder rate did increase slightly, but the rate of other violent crimes continued to decline, including in the 5th Precinct. Officer Gaines spotted someone he knew out in the yard as we drove along. We stopped to talk to retired fire department Captain David Brown, and I told him what his neighbors have been telling me.
They get the idea that they don't see any police officers. Have you found that to be true or not?
That's true.
You're talking to one right
I'm
now?
I'm talking to one. You see one on occasion, but there's not enough of them.
Brown thinks too often the police are tied up answering 911 emergency calls to patrol residential streets as much as he'd like to see. We also stopped by Zena Knight's house, and she thinks crime is up in Morningside, but she doesn't think it's because the police aren't around.
We need more policemen like him. Many more.
So what is your impression about crime in Morningside?
Well, I'm the president of this block club, and it's getting worse. It's about them not respecting the police. You know, a lady just got killed at the corner house last Saturday. I can't give you an answer to what is really causing the problem right now, but it's not for the like of them.
She was looking right at Officer Gaines. She made clear she thinks he's one of the good guys. Detroit does seem to have the right level of officers on the street. According to FBI statistics, Detroit actually has more than the average number of cops for its population. In 2015, in larger cities in the Midwest, for every 10,000 people, the average was 29 officers. Detroit had 33 officers. Neighborhood Patrol Officer DeAndre Gaines says they are there in the neighborhoods.
We are patrolling the area at least 5 days a week. Various hours depending on where the complaints take us. We also do what we call safe passage, which is assisting the children getting to school safe. I do that along with NPO Scott. So we're out there morning and evening making sure this community is safe.
And that's just the MPOs, the community policing face of the police force. Other patrol officers are also working 24/7. It seems reasonable that even though the city has a good number of police, with its crime rate generally among the top five in the nation, the police are just busy. Too busy to do those slow rolls through those residential areas of the city. With the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, I'm Lester Graham, Michigan Radio News.
Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative on Michigan Radio comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Up next, Michigan Civil War infantryman Frank Thompson had a secret. He was a she.
After 8 years of effort, it literally took an act of Congress to get her the rightful recognition she deserves.
The story of Sarah Seeley in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time now for Songs from Studio East, where we bring you some of the best music coming out of Michigan. Stateside's Mercedes Mejia introduces us to this Ann Arbor artist.
John Holk and the Sequins, we are what I call a psychedelic country rock band. We were formed in 2006, basically because I had a couple really good musicians that were willing to play my songs with me, and I was dabbling in country music and country-sounding stuff, although it's really not country music.
That's John Hokobor talking about how the band's hybrid musical style came to be.
We thought it was really fun and hilarious to do old-fashioned like Hank Williams and Merle Haggard tunes along with just psychedelic rock songs. We always loved the tension between those two genres.
Based in Southeast Michigan, the band has two full-length albums out. Where You Going is the name of their second album that was released in 2016. Despite the playful combination of genres in his music, Hokobor's roots are more traditional. He studied classical music and composition at the University of Michigan, where he played bass in the orchestra. But after graduation, Hokobor was pulled closer to pop music.
And I was led to people like the Beatles, Bob Dylan, Hank Williams. Just dove deep into their books and decided I wanted to write lyrics and sing. And I was playing in a lot of instrumental bands. It was kind of strange, and it was mainly because nobody had the guts to actually stand up and sing. And so I said, I can do that, foolishly.
In 2010, Hokobor released his first record, and it was nominated for a Detroit Music Award for Best Country Album that year.
Thank you. What was funny about the first record, If You See Her, was that we got a lot of great reviews and press from the power pop world, which is a different musical genre unto itself, and I like to think of power pop as being the Beatles school of songwriting. And so I was very flattered that these people were responding to the music, and so I, in a way, I gave myself the latitude to be more power poppy on the second record.
On the second album, Hookabore dives even deeper into what he calls psychedelic pop, and for the first time adding electronic samples. But the honky-tonk influence is still there.
It's a powerful love in the band. Everybody in the band loves country music, especially old-fashioned country music. Not such big fans of modern country music, just the old-fashioned stuff. Hank Williams, Merle Haggard, Waylon Jennings, these sorts of things. And when we play a party, we're going to play some country music. It's just going to happen. Like, it's what we have a book of like 60 country songs that we play from, so it cannot but influence us in some way.
In addition to old-school country, Hookabore says he's inspired by gospel music, and you can hear it in his songwriting. Here's John Hoke and the Sequins performing the song May the First Man Fall, here in Studio East.
I was walking down by your window, think of what to say. I told you once I would not be moved, and you could not persuade. Now you're looking down from your window. Now I know what to say. If it's a game, then I'll let you. I'll steal your heart away.
I made The First Man Fall, and it's a tune that I've just, it's one of those tunes that I've been kicking around for a long time, and I somehow came up on this line, remember this, it was just one kiss that made the first man fall. And I liked that line just because it sounded vaguely biblical, like it was referring to Adam and Eve somehow, and I love gospel music. It's another one of my passions. And I just love especially like Appalachian hillbilly music that uses any type of gospel imagery. I just love it. So anytime I can sort of fake some gospel hillbilly lyrics, I run with it.
For those inclined to dismiss anything associated with country music, you might be surprised with this album.
Once you open yourself up to it and you start just saying, if you can't beat 'em, join 'em, a wonderful world is open to you of great music and great lyrics and great sentiments. And really, the thing people always say is, you know, I like country music because it tells a story, and that is absolutely true.
John Hulk and the Sequins will be performing Thursday, June 29th at the Whitney in Detroit, and then in Ann Arbor on Thursday, August 17th at the Nash Bash at Carytown Farmers Market. For Stateside, I'm Mercedes Mejia.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
United Nations considers a war stopped even more important than a war won.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
In 1884, Congress passed a bill recognizing the service of and granting a pension to Sarah Emma Evelyn Edmondson Seeley for her service to the country in the Civil War as a soldier in Company F of the 2nd Michigan Volunteer Infantry Regiment, where she served under the name of Franklin Thompson. It's Wednesday, and that means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. And here to share the story of female Civil War soldier Sarah Seeley is the Michigan History Center's Eric Perkins and Mark Harvey. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Cynthia.
Hey.
So tell us, where does the story of Sarah Seeley begin, Eric?
Right. So Sarah Edmondson, as her original name, was actually from New Brunswick in Canada, and she's born in 1841. Born to a poor farmer in New Brunswick there, and he was disappointed that he didn't get a son. And apparently he was very abusive to Sarah. She really had a rough time of it. But it was when he arranged a marriage with one of his creditors to marry her off to him that she decided to run away. And she ran away, and in order to protect her identity, she actually changed her name to Frank Thompson and disguised herself as a man and immigrated to the United States.
So she came to the U.S. as Frank Thompson.
Frank Thompson, that's right. She was selling Bibles and books in New England under that name. And if you think about it, actually changing her identity to a young man would actually make it easier to travel back then as well, because, you know, an unescorted young lady would have raised a lot of eyebrows at the time.
What brought her to Michigan?
I'm not exactly sure, honestly. She did end up in Flint. I think there was another Canadian that she knew there, but she ended up in Flint, and when the war broke out, the Civil War broke out, she actually joined up with the 2nd Michigan Infantry.
Do we know why? Do we know what sparked that decision to volunteer?
Various sources say, one source I saw said she was compelled to do it. There was kind of a fervor for volunteers. You know, again, if you were a young man, you were sort of expected to volunteer. But also, you know, she cites patriotism, and that was probably an element of it. And then she also was an anti-slavery person, you know, against slavery. So those would have all been contributing factors to her decision. But she did join the 2nd and followed them as long as she could.
And what were some of her duties with the 2nd?
Well, she started out a nurse, which was considered to be a male job in the Army. In fact, up through the Spanish-American War, the Army thought that it could handle nursing duties in wartime with male nurses, or they were called stewards. But the Civil War should have proved, and the Spanish-American War did prove, that they couldn't handle the workload with male personnel, and that they had to, at first, use female volunteers who weren't really welcome, actually, in the hospitals to start. So nursing was where she started, and then she ended up being a courier, relaying messages, you know, on horseback. And so those were the first things that she did.
Do we know if she saw combat?
According to her accounts, she did, and probably from the pension accounts, I think they cite that as well. There are some other aspects of her career that are a little bit more up for debate.
Meaning, things that perhaps were attached to her, do we know what those are?
Well, she claims in her memoir that she wrote, Nurse and Spy in the Union Army, that she was engaged in some espionage or some spying. And that just, you know, there's some debate about whether there's evidence for that or not. But there are very colorful accounts of her, again, going in different disguises behind enemy lines and things like that.
You know, I stop and I think, Eric Perkins, that soldiers then and now live in very, very close quarters, especially in the Civil War. Do we know how she pulled this off, masquerading as a man?
It's hard to say. There had to have been soldiers that looked the other way. Having said that, if you're working in as a nurse or something like that, you might be able to get some separate quarters for yourself, you know, not necessarily one of those two-man pump tent deals. So working as a courier or a nurse, you know, she probably was able to find other sleeping arrangements. And, you know, if she were careful, she could certainly have pulled it off. And there were the low estimate, 400 to, you know, more recent estimates of 1,000 women in both sides who, you know, disguised themselves with varying degrees of success.
Now, Mark Harvey, as the war continued, she left the Army. Did you get to leave the Army during the Civil War? I mean, I think we all tend to think they went marching off, and then if they survived, they marched home after the war ended in 1865.
Well, it wasn't that simple. So the 2nd Michigan Infantry that she served in, they had sort of been ramping up their activity in the war. They served at the First Battle of Bull Run, then they served at the Siege of Yorktown, and then things really began to heat up in the war, and her unit served at the Second Battle of Manassas and then Fredericksburg. So she suffered some injuries. One account had her horse being shot out from underneath her and then being thrown off a mule and breaking a limb. She recovered from that, and by 1863, her unit was transferred to the Army of the Cumberland out in Kentucky, and that's when she contracted malaria. Got really sick, requested a furlough, which was not surprisingly denied, and not wanting to be discovered, she left her unit to recover and was subsequently charged with desertion. So she didn't just get to march off. She was charged with desertion because she was sick and didn't want to be discovered.
So what happened? Because didn't deserters get shot?
She wasn't found out before the end of the war, so she was able to recede and resume her role as a woman working in a nursing capacity. So she did have that advantage that when she wanted to disappear, she could disappear.
No more Frank Thompson.
No more Frank Thompson.
Now, after the war, she wrote a memoir, Nurse and Spy in the Union Army. How was that memoir received?
It was really popular. It did very well. It was published in the first year, and then it was picked up, and the title was slightly changed, and it was republished, and it was still very popular, but it caused some problems.
How so?
Well, a few things. One, she's a woman. It's the 1860s, and this isn't a, you know, it's not a time of liberation for women, and it was edgy stuff. This was partially fictionalized, but it was still a woman dressing as a man, serving in the Civil War. It was pretty edgy.
Pushing boundaries, indeed.
Absolutely.
What did life have in store for Sarah Seely in the decades following the Civil War?
After the war, she married Linus Seely, where she gets another addition to her long string of names, in 1867, and they had children. They eventually settled in LaPorte, Texas. How you go from New Brunswick, Canada, to Michigan, to Texas is beyond me.
That, there's totally a movie that needs to be made. Yeah. This is fascinating. Now, what got Congress involved in the 1880s to recognize and grant a pension to Sarah?
Well, as the story goes, and I think it's important with Sarah to always tiptoe through that boundary of fact and fiction, because her own account was partially fictionalized, and everyone that she touched along the way wants to claim Sarah as part of their story. Sometimes the facts get changed to suit whatever situation that, you know, the place that's claiming her. So we try to be careful with that.
Fluid with the facts.
Fluid with the facts. So she attended a reunion of the 2nd Michigan Infantry in 1876. By her account and others, she was warmly received by her soldiers. They probably read her book. And some people there emboldened her to seek a pension. She was severely injured, and it was just this nagging health condition that she carried the rest of her life. She was injured and served honorably. She was tenacious, and she deserved a pension as much as anybody else. Her only roadblock was her gender.
So it was realized that she didn't leave because of cowardice.
Correct.
Yes.
Right. And so House Bill 5335 of 1884 starts with, "Truth is oft-times stranger than fiction," and now comes the sequel. Sarah E. Edmonds, now Sarah E. Seely, alias Franklin Thompson, is now asking this Congress to grant her relief by way of a pension on account of fading health, which she avers had its incurrence at the sequence of the days and nights she spent in the swamps of the Chickahominy and the days she spent soldiering. After 8 years of effort, it literally took an act of Congress to get her the rightful recognition she deserved. So the desertion charge was removed in 1884, and with that act of Congress, she received a $12 a month pension, which I could not resist looking up today's value.
Yeah.
It's a whopping $290 a month.
My goodness. How long did Sarah live?
She died on September 5th, 1898, in Texas. And she was eventually buried with full military honors and is the only woman inducted into the Veterans Organization, the Grand Army of the Republic, which is a Civil War Veterans Organization.
Absolutely. Fascinating, fascinating story. And again, somebody out there needs to grab this and make a movie out of it, or some kind of a cable miniseries, because I'm telling you, it would be a hit. Mark Harvey and Eric Perkins of the Michigan History Center, we want to thank you for sharing the story of Sarah Evelyn Edmondson Seely, the Michigan woman who enlisted as Franklin Thompson, serving with the 2nd Michigan Volunteer Infantry Regiment in the Civil War. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, her ex-husband went to prison for stalking her, But that did not end the nightmare for an Ypsilanti woman.
I received a phone call in November stating that another inmate had come forward stating that my ex-husband was offering him now $5,000 to kill me with a lethal dose of heroin.
Up next, we'll continue talking with Nicole Beverly. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Yesterday, we introduced you to Nicole Beverly. For years, she was violently abused by her ex-husband, Kevin. He's now in prison for an aggravated stalking conviction, but he's scheduled to be released on August 24th. As we continue my conversation with Nicole, she tells us how, even from prison, her ex continues to threaten to kill her and their two sons. How did you find out? You've been told by authorities that he's made threats against you. I mean, how did you learn this?
Yes. And there have been multiple attempts to hire that I've been notified. The first one was in Washtenaw County.
To hire inmates.
Okay. The first one was in Washtenaw County in 2012. And that was when he was awaiting sentencing on the aggravated stalking charge. An inmate came forward there stating that my now ex-husband had approached him and offered him $50,000. To chloroform me and inject me with a lethal dose of heroin. And that inmate passed a polygraph test. He was willing to testify and or wear a wire if Washtenaw County would cut him some type of a deal. And at that time, Washtenaw County prosecutors decided not to do that. So the inmate was unwilling to testify or wear the wire. And I had been notified about that investigation by Washtenaw County Sheriff's Department. Then fast forward to him being transferred to Jackson Prison. He was approved for parole after 15 months, which was his minimum sentence date. And the day that they transferred him from Jackson Prison to the Detroit Reentry Center, which is a step down before you're paroled, two inmates came forward at Jackson Prison writing letters that are quite compelling, stating that my ex-husband was on a regular basis saying that as soon as he got out, he was going to come to my home and kill my children in front of me.
I can't imagine what the normal is for you and your sons having this onslaught of threats. I don't know. I don't know how to imagine it.
Yeah, it's almost something we've become used to. And after the letters, and I do have copies of the letters, like I said, that were very graphic and are very difficult to read. They did contact Detroit Reentry Center, and they pulled him into isolation, and two inmates came forward there saying that he was offering them $50,000 to kill me and my children. And he was saying that the money, because people always ask me, well, how would he have that much money? And what he was stating at that time was that he still had a life insurance policy on me. And there was a life insurance policy, and it had a very high cash out. But the other thing is he had taken all of our assets. So we don't know how much money he had. He had taken about $80,000 out of all of our retirement savings, education funds for the kids. So I don't know. The money potentially was there.
So he was supposed to be paroled. He was a step away from being paroled. They pulled him back. And then did he get resentenced to what happened to keep him in?
So once I was notified about the inmates at Jackson writing the letters and the inmates at Detroit Reentry coming forward saying he was soliciting them for my murder, state police in Wayne County were handling that investigation. They had interviewed those inmates and were going to be going back to interview them and potentially wire them for further evidence. And the day that detective went back to complete that investigation, he learned that without his knowledge, in the police report it states he doesn't understand why, Jackson Prison had pulled my ex-husband back to Jackson before the investigation could be completed and before any wired evidence could be obtained. The case then was assigned to a detective, another state detective, and 3 weeks went by, and Washtenaw County, again, was trying to help and find out what was happening in the case, made some phone calls. The detective then learned he was supposed to be not only finishing up the investigation about the case at Detroit Reentry, but also the letters written at Jackson Prison, and he made the decision to simply interview my ex-husband and decided, based on his body language, that he was telling the truth and that he was not wanting to hurt me or hire anyone to hurt me, simply based on his body language.
So he dismissed all that as unfounded.
He dismissed it all as unfounded, and there was no follow-up by the state police.
And I know ultimately your ex wound up in Newberry, and the same thing happened. Somebody agreed to wear a wire, right?
That is correct. He, as a result of the letters, the Michigan Department of Corrections did make the decision to not authorize his parole. And he eventually was sent to Newberry Correctional Facility in the Upper Peninsula. And I received a phone call in November stating that another inmate had come forward stating that my ex-husband was offering him now $5,000 to kill me, and to kill me in the same way that the first inmate in 2012 was going to kill me, and that was with a lethal dose of heroin.
I think of the story you're telling, and it seems that there are so many movable parts in all of this, so many different agencies. And I'm wondering, as you turn to all of these agencies, to the police, to the parole, to the prison authorities, what happens?
Well, it's been very surprising to me how little flow of communication there is between all of these entities, because when I was contacted by each of these state police detectives, none of them were aware of the previous cases.
His time's about up. He gets out August 24th, unless?
My understanding, the inmate at Newberry was willing to wear a wire. He was not asking for a deal. He wasn't asking for anything, any time off. He just was reportedly very concerned about the boys and I being murdered. And he wore a wire on several occasions, and my understanding, although I have not yet seen the police report from talking to the detective, is that the wire that had the most evidence was inaudible due to a football game being on in the background, and that they were unable to separate enough of the clear audio to, in the opinion of the prosecutor in Luce County, he made the decision not to move forward with charges because he feels an inmate's testimony isn't enough. I have not talked to him personally. That's just what I've been told. And my question is, Ben, well, I understand one inmate, but what about six inmates? Is that not credible enough to have all of these people coming forward and trying to help us and having been willing to do that?
Do you see any avenue that could keep him locked up past August 24th?
My understanding is that the Attorney General's office has the most power to do something to help us at this point in time, being that there are cases from multiple counties that could potentially be pulled together into one case, that the Attorney General's office is our best hope at getting new charges and getting the help that we need to stay safe and to be able to stay in Michigan.
Because we know that August 24th is the parole date. He's supposed to be released with a tether monitor with GPS, but isn't that just for the first 60 days, or would he wear that?
His max sentencing date is October 24th of this year. So once he hits that date, he is off of everything. And that was something that I wasn't aware of. My having never really dealt with the legal system before, I assumed that once you hit that max sentencing date, then you were put on parole, but that's not the case. The case is, once he hits that max sentencing date, there's nothing. There's no one to hold him accountable. There's no one watching his movement. There's nothing.
Tell us about the safety plan that you had to put together and follow.
So as the release date was approaching for my ex-husband, Washington County prosecutors and sheriff's department wanted to come together with my family to create a safety plan that would involve having my house highlighted so that if I called 911, it would be a fast response. Also, having SWAT come to my house to map it so that if there is a hostage situation or he ends up in my home, they would already have a layout of my home. They also requested dental records for myself and my children because they realize the lethality risk that my ex-husband poses to us. So we kind of sat down and talked about all these things and put an action plan into place before release.
That's tough to think, okay, here are my dental records, and realize why you have to give them.
That was probably the most difficult thing that someone has said to me in terms of that because it just the reality struck me very hard. And that the fact that they realize and recognize that this is very likely to happen to us and no one's doing anything.
So what are you going to do?
I'm going to relocate. If the powers that be don't do what we need to do or for them to do for us to help us, I have to leave the state and I essentially have to disappear.
New identity, new everything.
New everything.
But do you worry about your friends and family who will know where you're at and he'll know them?
I do. I worry about my mom the most, being vulnerable, of course, because, you know, you hear these cases all the time where people get out and if they can't get to the person they're trying to hurt, they hurt the people closest to them. So that is a very real fear that I have.
There are people listening to your story who are going to want to ask this question, so I will ask it for them. What can people do to help you?
So at this point, I have a friend who has done a few things. The first thing she did initially was set up a GoFundMe for relocation because once I changed my identity, what I'm being told by national experts is that it's going to be very hard for me to obtain employment because once I have to explain why I've changed my identity and my profession as a clinical social worker, a lot of companies are not going to want to take the risk. I'm putting clients in jeopardy if I'm a safety risk. And as a result of the GoFundMe, people have also been asking who they can contact. And we've basically are suggesting the Attorney General's office, Bill Schuette, also state representatives to try to help put a little pressure on the people who have the power to do something to help myself and my children. Yesterday, it was very painful. My younger son made a video. It was a video. He was saying goodbye to his friends and telling them that he had to leave the state and he would never see them again. And it hit me very hard because as an adult, it's one thing to deal with these things, but for a child, it's so unfair. And one thing I want to say, too, is one of the reasons people ask, well, why don't you just stay and why don't you just have a gun and protect yourself. And I do have a CPL and I do carry, but I can't carry at work and I can't be looking over our shoulder and I can't be with my kids 24/7 to protect them. And after the safety planning meeting, I was on the fence about whether to leave or not. But there was an incident that occurred about 2 weeks ago where I had to call 911 and it took them 1 hour and 6 minutes to respond to my call and get to my house. And I knew at that moment that I can't stay here. It's not safe for us.
Nicole Beverly, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Here with us now is Barbara Neese-May, Executive Director of Safe House Center in Ann Arbor. They've been working with Nicole Beverly through her ordeal. Barbara, how common is Nicole's situation?
Her story is common in that there are many survivors who find themselves needing to relocate because of the assailant. What's uncommon is the fact that she has gone public with her story, and she has really explained to many, many people on many different levels what's happened to her.
So how do you see the system, air quotes here, having failed Nicole and her two sons?
The system failed her in that there isn't a willingness to continue to investigate what's happening. The assailant is in prison, and he has made threats, and they are not willing to investigate. The bottom line is that if there is a willingness for law enforcement to further explore what has happened to Nicole by virtue of this, then she wouldn't be in this position of having to raise money to go underground, to uproot her and her children. Survivors of domestic violence should not have to displace themselves and their children because of assailant behavior. And that is exactly what is happening here.
So let's talk about what do we not have in place in Michigan that we should have, that could have protected her from her ex and these threats?
What we don't have in place is all law enforcement agencies being on board with holding assailants accountable. In Washtenaw County, we do have that, I would say, for the most part. What we don't have is a statewide shared understanding that when assailants continue to assault and hurt and threaten survivors, there isn't the decision to say, we are going to continue to hold them accountable. They just throw their hands up in the air and say, well, what can we do? I think it's also a situation of they're saying, well, here's a convict blaming another convict, trying to get a deal to get out. That's not it at all. This is a credible threat that is made by someone who has threatened her in the past, who has said this is what the outcome is going to be. And we are forgetting about Shander Turner. Shander Turner was killed approximately 4 or 5 years ago in Washtenaw County. She let parole know, hey, he is threatening to kill me. And they still let him out. Within 4 days, she was stabbed in front of her sons. Now, this is something that absolutely can happen. And in Washtenaw County, we don't see a lot of homicides. It happened.
So what should happen to her ex, do you think?
I think what should happen is that at least they hold him for investigation and that they try to understand where he's going with this. Have they ever asked him, what is your intent? Has he gone through any programming while he's in prison to unlearn this abusive behavior? What has happened since he went to prison? And if he has not gone through any programming, if he isn't showing any kind of remorse for what he did in the past, and if he has zero plans for when he gets out of prison, then certainly we should be worried. I don't even think that there has been something put in place where he has a no-contact order or that he's being told he can't live within X number of miles. She has had no communication and no support from the system.
Michigan's among 14 states without an address confidentiality program. What would that look like if we had it? How could that help her stay in Michigan?
That would help her stay in Michigan because of a variety of things. One is that he wouldn't be able to have access to that information. She would be shielded from some of these internet searches and things like that. Now, some people think, oh, come on, in this day and age, you can find anybody. However, what if we decided that wasn't the case in Michigan? What if we said we are going to hold people who have experienced particularly sexual assault and domestic violence in such high regard that we are going to protect them? Then of course we could do it.
We're going to have a lot of people who've listened to Nicole's story, been moved by Nicole's story, and want to do something, call somebody, advocate for her in some way. What's the best thing that could be done right now as we're talking to help her?
I think to contact their legislator to say, I am part of protecting and supporting survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence, and also to let the Attorney General know, I stand with Nicole and her two sons and the fact that they deserve to not have to move, not to have to interrupt their lives because of this abusive, convicted felon's behavior.
And the clock is ticking. August 24th is getting closer and closer.
August 24th is coming up rapidly.
Barbara Neese May, Executive Director of Safe House in Ann Arbor. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We reached out to Attorney General Bill Schuette's office. A spokesperson said they are looking into Nicole Beverly's case, and they're unable to comment any further at this time. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Ellie Billings, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Petulana Ali, and Jacob Meschke. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.